evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Here are some of the stories we're covering today, Wednesday, April 6, 2016. Former rebels of the SPLA-IO say government forces have attacked their bases before the formation of the Transitional Government of National Unity.
You know, they attacked our defensive position in Western Dardagan around 3 p.m. and at the same time, they also went and carried aerial attack also at 3 p.m.
And residents in Wau say they cannot bury their dead in cemeteries because of insecurity.
When I lost my father last month, we faced a lot of challenges at the main entrance of Busari. The soldiers there told us to pay 500 SSP or else we have to take our dead body back home.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. Just days before South Sudan's two warring parties are expected to form the Transitional Government of National Unity, the SPLA in opposition are accusing the government of attacking their positions in parts of Greater Bahar Ghazal and Upper Nile states. SPLA-IO spokesman William Gadjat then alleges the government forces attacked the opposition's bases yesterday. The government is dismissing the accusation as baseless. Mungume Debs Rakarinj has more for VOA from Juba.
SPLA-IO spokesperson Colonel William Gadjat Deng says government forces have been attacking their bases since the beginning of this week. He says government soldiers attacked SPLA-IO forces at Monatena in the former Western Bahar Ghazal area along Mayendit Railroad in the former Unity State.
Yesterday at noon time, you know, German army gunship, you know, they attacked our defensive position in Western Bahar Ghazal around 2 p.m. and at the same time, they also went and carry aerial attack also at 3 p.m.
Deng also accuses government forces of looting civilians' properties, including cattle. He says, although the fighting has subsidized for now, residents are now living in fear.
At the moment, as you know, the government sent the heavily armored gunship around Wau, where our forces are staged. And currently, as you know, the government is on the offensive. We cannot be able to disclose our hiding out. And even now, the security is still being tense.
SPLA spokesman Brigadier Lur Ruai Kong denies the rebels' accusations.
It is not true. We have not launched any attacks against SPLA positions in anywhere in South Sudan. The situation is normal. It has become a regular habit for the rebels to say anything that they want. It has become their habit. I think they are just seeking publicity.
Gajiak Deng denies that, insisting the SPLA-IO wants peace.
We are committed to peace, and that is the reason why we send our forces to Cuba. So if we are not committed to peace agreement that it has been signed, why should we send our forces to Cuba for implementation and also to be part of security arrangement?
More than 700 forces of First Vice President designate Riek Machar have arrived in Juba ahead of his expected return to the capital next week to participate in forming the Transitional Government of National Unity. For VOA News, I am Mugume Debs Rakarinj in Juba.
And now we turn to Wau for some sad story. Residents in Wau say insecurity on the southern and western outskirts of the town is so rampant they cannot bury their loved ones. Since fighting erupted, residents have been burying deceased relatives in their homes rather than risk their lives traveling to public cemeteries. And some residents accuse government forces of demanding money to provide security at burial sites. Michael Atit has more for VOA from Wau.
There are two cemeteries in Wau. One is for Christians, located about half kilometers south of the town, and another is for Muslims, and located about a kilometer west of the town. But both Christians and Muslims say in the last few months they have been unable to access the cemeteries whenever they lose a loved one because of the ongoing fighting. 39-year-old Teresa Joseph lost her father and two siblings during the recent violence in Wau. She says her three family members were buried at home. Speaking in Arabic, Joseph says she is afraid that the family's plot of land which measures 20 by 20 meters, will already be filled with tombs. And besides, she says, they can't afford the bribes demanded by soldiers they meet on their way to the cemetery.
When I lost my father last month, we faced a lot of challenges at the main entrance of Busari. The soldiers there told us to pay 500 SSP or else we have to take our dead body back home. I told them I don't have money to pay them. As a result, we were forced to go back and bury my father on the next day in the house.
Joseph says it is impossible for her and many of the citizens to go and bury their relatives at the two public cemeteries. She says government soldiers accuse any residents they come across who are conducting a burial of being rebel supporters. 37-year-old Awadala Juma was also forced to bury his 16-year-old brother at home, even though his Muslim religion prohibits that. Speaking in Arabic, Juma says, even though the family buried his brother more than 40 days ago, seeing the tomb at home still bothers his family members.
The situation could not allow us to go and bury our brother because Muslim cemetery is far from the town, so we had to bury his body at home, even though our religion is against this. As you know, when someone is buried at home, it has a lot of effect and stress. You cannot easily forget your relative, and this is now affecting all our family members.
Both Joseph and Juma are calling on the Wawi state government to secure the two cemeteries so residents can once again safely bury their loved ones outside their homes. Last month, when Professor Arkanjulu Barry Wanji, a member of the National Assembly, died, he was buried at his home in Wau's Haijebel residential area. Before his death, Wanji's wish was to be laid to rest at his village in Golingbo, more than a kilometer west of Wau town. Family members say they could not carry out his last wish due to insecurity in the area. Stephen Robo Musa, a civil society activist working with the Community Empowerment for Progress organization in Wau, says the government must ensure that graveyards are protected areas so people can bury their loved ones according to their wishes.
This is really a challenge, and it is also a very painful experience where you bury your own person within your premises. And if you look at from the side of a health point of view, it's not safe for the family themselves. Humanly point of view, culturally, where people have a special respect for that body. All of us, you know that one day we will pass from this world to another world, and where we need our body to be laid respectfully.
Asked what the municipality is doing to address residents' concerns, Wau Town Mayor Akola Kola Jit declined to comment, saying he has yet to receive an official complaint. South Sudan in Focus could not get comments from military authorities about the allegation of bribery because the tense security situation around Wau Town. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Wau.
Residents of Abyei Town are welcoming the establishment of a magistrate's court in the disputed region. The court is being established by South Sudanese judiciary authorities to replace traditional customary courts which residents have relied on for generations. Residents say in the past they had to travel long distances to seek justice in courts outside the region. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports for VOA from Wau.
Agok Dao says Abyei residents have been traveling as far as Tralee in the former Warabi state to seek justice that is more than 30 kilometers away. Speaking in Arabic, Dao says now that the area has its own court, residents will no longer have to travel long distances to settle their differences.
We had difficulties before in terms of transport to reach Tralee, where cases were judged, and we were eager to have a court near here. Now we have one. This is good news for us.
Agok says in the past, many residents who could not afford to travel to distant courts resorted to the customary courts run by traditional chiefs. Byung Piang, head of the Abyei Legal Administration, says residents will have access to justice once the court is functioning.
Establishment order of Abyei Special Administrative area, which was actually issued last year by the President, Sir Fakir Mayadid, and given the illegal status as one of the special administrative areas within South Sudan, the judiciary should be established. And now what we are doing, we are just implementing the establishment order.
But Abyei is a contested region between South Sudan and Sudan that has no legal jurisdiction in either country at the moment. Still, South Sudanese officials say the Abyei Administrative Area Court will use South Sudanese laws, including the Transitional Constitution and the Panel Court. Piang says all pending murder cases will now be addressed in Abyei.
The murder cases were sent to Turale, where there is a judiciary in Turale, but these simple minor crimes were being handled by traditional courts. But mainly the murders and these big crimes were sent to Turale, and up to now some of the cases are still in Turale. It is when we open the court here that these cases are supposed to be transferred back to Abyei.
Andrew Joseph Lado, the judge designated to handle cases for the Abyei area, says is ready to start work.
Yeah, I hope that this court will state all these cases that are pending in the police station, because we are waiting, because for me, I'm waiting for many times to open this court, but now, starting from today, so I've given an order to the legal administrative in the Abyei area here, so that all the cases to be submitted to be submitted to the court, so that the court will finalize these cases.
Ball Beck, the Abyei Administrative Area Paramount Chief, says the establishment of the Magistrates Court of Abyei will give traditional chiefs an opportunity to concentrate on their issues. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Wau.
From Wau, we move to Kenya, where former political rivals President Uhuru Kenyatta and Deputy President William Ruto united in 2013 in the face of ICC indictments. The men have exploited the international scrutiny to their political advantage. Now that the heat is off, the reconciliation will be tested and Ruto may take a play for the presidency in 2017. The total lack of accountability for 2007-2008 post-election violence would set a worrying precedent, as we hear from Muhammad Yusuf in Nairobi.
Thousands of people took to the streets in Kenya's Rift Valley region to celebrate after the International Criminal Court ruled to vacate charges against Deputy President William Ruto. Colonel Mwema is the Secretary General of New Ford Kenya, one of the political parties in the ruling Jubilee coalition.
It bolsters him politically very seriously, both nationally and in his backyard in Rift Valley, because now he will be able to act more freely, more forcefully, and make decisions without looking over his shoulder.
Kenyan political writer Barak Muluka says if Ruto runs for president in 2017, the country may not have a clear winner. The election could pit him against President Uhuru Kenyatta, potentially reigniting communal rivalries that led to the violence after the 2007 election.
If he calculates and he has got that popular following within Rift Valley, he could also say to himself, why should I be deputy president when I could be president? And of course, he would throw the game wide open.
In 2007, Kenyatta and Ruto were on opposite sides. More than 1,100 people were killed and 600,000 displaced in the violence that followed the 2007 election. The ICC charged Kenyatta, Ruto and a Kenyan radio director with crimes against humanity for allegedly orchestrating the violence. Kenyatta and Ruto then joined forces and won the 2013 election. They painted themselves as victims of Western neo-imperialism and called on Kenyans to reject the ICC. The two men insist their Jubilee coalition has reconciled communities in the Rift Valley, site of the most intense post-election violence in 2008. But communities there have clashed for decades over land and political supremacy, and ethnic rivalries continue to underscore national politics. Some accuse the current administration of favouring Kenyatta and Ruto's tribes, the Kikuyu and Kalenjin, something the government denies. Muluka says the ICC ruling this week sends a message. There is no accountability.
People who are not satisfied will believe that at home there's no authority that can deal with you. On the international circuit, there's nobody who can deal with you. It's a repeat of violence. It's very likely. We've seen violence in Kakamega. We have seen the way people have been behaving in parliament. And all these are indicators that violence is very, very possible.
Kenya's Attorney General Githu Muigai said Tuesday the government will put in place mechanism to prosecute perpetrators of political violence. But critics say justice will be hampered by the same kind of political meddling and witness intimidation that, according to rights activists, led the ICC to dismiss its cases against Kenyatta and Ruto for lack of evidence. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Coming up, tomorrow is World Diabetes Day. Find out what health authorities are doing to address the disease.
What do you think? People speak out on important questions. The question today:
are women treated fairly in your country? Explain.
I think, to my observation, women in other way around, they are treated fairly, but not all that they are treated fairly. Because when we consider in the form of maybe distributing resources in form of maybe giving them job, I think they are not all that treated fairly.
In some communities, women are treated badly. Women are not recognized.
Okay, it is like women are not really, they have never get chance for going to school, especially when they were still girl. That one is also a weakness, and it's also, it is like when you are a woman, you are not capable to do anything, simply because you have never get the same chance with men.
What do you think? A daily discussion of important questions from VOA.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus. The World Health Organization reports 422 million adults are living with diabetes, a four-fold increase over 1980 figures. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from the launch of WHO's Global Report on Diabetes in Geneva.
The release of this report in advance of World Health Day is meant as a call to global action to halt the rise of type 2 diabetes, which is killing 1.5 million people a year. The World Health Organization estimates 43% of these deaths occur prematurely before the age of 70. The UN agency says diabetes is no longer a disease of the wealthy. Most cases now are found in middle and low-income countries. The WHO says the highest rates are in the Middle East, Southeast Asia, and the Western Pacific. The WHO report says the dramatic rise of this deadly disease is largely due to the increasing number of overweight and obese people. It reports more than 1 in 3 adults is overweight and more than 1 in 10 is obese. Etienne Krug is the director of WHO's Department for Management of Noncommunicable Diseases. He says diabetics will suffer complications from the disease if it is not detected in a timely manner and treated.
People with diabetes have a 2 to 3 times higher risk of cardiovascular disease. They have a 10 to 20 times higher risk of lower limb amputation. Diabetes is an important cause of blindness through diabetic retinopathy and an important cause of end-stage renal disease.
Krug tells VOA the economic cost of diabetes can be catastrophic for both the individual and society. He notes that monthly insulin treatment, which is a question of life and death for many patients, can be expensive.
We know that just the annual direct medical costs exceed $827 billion every year. So it's a very, very vast, large number. And that is not taking into account many other types of costs, such as lost productivity, etc., etc.
The UN agency says adopting a healthy lifestyle can prevent the majority of cases. The report's recommendations include eating healthier, engaging in more physical activity, and avoiding excessive weight gain. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For 7 years, Boko Haram militants have waged a fundamentalist insurgence in three Nigeria's northeastern states, killing 20,000 and displacing more than a million civilians. After a three-week joint Nigeria-Cameroonian military campaign, officials have announced the capture of more than 300 rebel fighters and the release of more than 2,000 captive civilians. VOA's David Arnold spoke with Abubakar Haruna Galdanji in Kano about the military offensive.
The Nigerian Defense Headquarters, located in Abuja, stated that they have arrested almost 306 members of the Boko Haram with joint operation between the Nigerian army and the Cameroonian troops around Maiduguri and Adamawa. That is where the Boko Haram are located. It took them almost 2 to 3 weeks, people, which later they successfully arrested 306 members of Boko Haram, including one of the top leaders of the Boko Haram at the area.
Were they able to identify the name of this leader of Boko Haram?
Today, they didn't identify the actual name of the man. It can be recalled that in less than 1 week, the leader of the Boko Haram, that is Abubakar Shekau, appeared in a new video saying that he is calling to all his members to surrender to Nigerian troops as well as the Cameroonian and the other neighboring countries' troops. That's what he is saying. For now, they spent almost 7 years fighting Nigerian government. For now, it's okay for them and they can surrender to Nigerian government to stop the normal bloodshed.
The report that we received yesterday also included the possibility that about 2,000 civilians who had been captured by Boko Haram have been released in this operation.
It's correct.
Is there any indication that this is a legitimate video that actually came from the leaders of Boko Haram?
Even from the Nigerian people, some of them are saying the video, they believe the video 100% is Boko Haram, while others are saying has already since more than 3 years ago is being killed by Nigerian troops. Consider the situation that Nigerian government is seeing. This conflict has already come to an end. But the problem is from time to time in a week, like 2 or 3 in a week, you can have that maybe in Adamawa or Yobe, Maiduguri, or some part of Cameroon territory, you have bomb explosion or gun attack in the mosque or in a church or something like that. The only possibility for throwing Boko Haram or ending this conflict is when the two governments, the Nigerian government and the Cameroonian government, when they join hands.
That is Abubakar Haruna Galdinchi in Kano talking to VOA's David Arnold. Uber, the U.S.-based online taxi company, operates a mobile app that allows consumers with smartphones to book cab services from Uber drivers who use their own cars. As the company makes inroads in Africa, entrepreneurs in West African nation of Ivory Coast are trying to stay one step ahead. Emily Yob reports from the Ivorian commercial capital, Abidjan, where at least 4 Uber-like car services have launched since last year.
Abidjan's distinctive orange taxis have been zigzagging through traffic here for decades. But recently, new competition has rolled onto the streets. In front of his house, TV producer Jean-Louis Zaibo hops into the unmarked car he ordered as the driver closes the door behind him. TaxiJet sent him the detail of the car and the driver by text message on his cell phone.
Dans le cadre de mes activités, j'ai beaucoup de choses. C'est pas évident que je retrouve cela.
Zaibo says he often carries a lot of things with him because of his work. If I forget it in a regular taxi, it's unlikely I'll get it back. And I insist on punctuality. It is paramount to me, he adds. At the headquarters of TaxiJet, all cars are tracked at all times. The service, which launched last June, now receives about 100 bookings a day. Most of TaxiJet's 500 drivers use their own traditional orange taxis, but the company has begun to expand its own fleet of unmarked vehicles to meet demand. Inspired by the American booking service Uber, TaxiJet co-founder Parfait Ouattara believes some Ivorians are ready to pay a bit more for better service.
TaxiJet est né d'une idée de joindre le confort.
The concept of TaxiJet is to provide comfortable and safe transportation for Ivorians, Ouattara says. Our drivers are qualified, they drive peacefully and are polite. Over the past year and a half, three other transportation companies have made similar bets in Abidjan, proposing various rates and levels of luxury. Taking one of these services unmarked cars costs an average of 50% more than hailing a traditional orange taxi. Entrepreneur Vang Sigoma launched his AfriCab service in Abidjan earlier this year.
Disponible à bord de nos véhicules, nous avons nos tablettes numériques.
Goma explains that in our taxis we have electronic tablets on which you can check emails and city guide. There is also a 4G network available on board. The Congolese entrepreneurs plan to expand throughout Africa and notably in his home country, but he chose to start in Abidjan. Abidjan is French-speaking Africa and West Africa's powerhouse, with a growth rate around 10%, Goma says. AfriCab targets all kinds of customers, but the people most likely to use the service are the middle class. And it is working. AfriCab has already had to double its fleet, and the company now has a partnership with a big hotel. So what does this mean for the city's thousands of orange taxis? Drissa Diaby of the local taxi union says they are trying to improve service. Some taxis now have GPS trackers. Others are fixing their meters, although many drivers still prefer to negotiate rates. Diaby says the union has requested a meeting with the Ministry of Transport to discuss the new car services, but he is not too worried about competition. We go to the working-class neighborhoods. We drive 24/7 to help Ivorians, Diaby says. These new companies are not here to help average Ivorians. They are here to help the rich. As for the cab drivers' notoriously reckless driving, Diaby says that's probably not going to change. He believes it's just part of navigating the city's crowded streets. Emily Yop for VOA News in Abidjan.
You're listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. Here is a recap of today's top stories with South Sudan in Focus editor Carol Van Damme.
Thanks, John. Days before South Sudan's two warring parties are expected to form the transitional government of national unity, the SPLA-IO is accusing the government of attacking their positions in Greater Bahal Ghazal and Upper Nile areas. An SPLA-IO spokesman says government forces attacked the opposition's bases yesterday. The government flatly denies the accusations. SPLA-IO spokesman Colonel William Gatjath Deng says government forces have been attacking their bases since the beginning of the week. Wau Town residents say insecurity on the southern and western outskirts of town is so prevalent that burying their loved ones is nearly impossible. Since the fighting erupted, residents have taken to burying deceased relatives in their homes rather than risk their lives traveling to ancestral plots. And finally, residents of Abyei Town are welcoming the establishment of a magistrate's court in the disputed region. The court's being established by South Sudanese judicial authorities to replace traditional customary courts, which residents have relied on for generations. And that's a look at some of today's top stories. I'm Carol Van Damme.
And that's our show for this Wednesday. We leave you with the song Abyei Pin by the famous Abyei Jazz Band. We have been listening to a test of Abyei Jazz Band with the song Abyei Pin. I'm John Tanza in Washington. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow evening for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.